You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attack of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have two special guests this evening to discuss the very strange circumstances of the death of Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Anton Scalia. It's a very bizarre case, and I'm very pleased to have with me a former professor of law, John Remington Graham, who is familiar with the Texas statutes that pertain to this case, and Scott Bennett, a former Army Intel and PsyOps officer, where we're going to share our thoughts about this case. Let's go to the first slide, Chance. Who dies with a pillow over their head? The former Army Intel officer suspects foul play and death of Scalia. We're talking about Ray Starman, who observes that the circumstances surrounding Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death are growing more suspicious by the minute. He points to the fact that the story seems to be changing. Initial reports he died of a heart attack, later denied. He questions why no autopsy was performed, why the body was quickly embalmed, erasing any chances for a coroner to conduct efficient toxicology tests. The same people who want you to believe Scalia died of a heart attack or natural causes are the same people who want you to believe that Hillary won the Iowa caucuses with six coin tosses, and the same people who want you to believe 50 years later that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman of President Kennedy. Scott, what's your take on this?
Well, I mean, the departure from the standard operating procedure and the departure from practices that are always invoked when any average person dies is blatant and extreme. The fact that they've done this to a Supreme Court justice, a representative of one of the three branches of our republic's government, and they haven't done anything to investigate this. They haven't had one person in Congress or the Senate stand up and challenge this and stop this. How in the world can this be the same America that we've always lived in, other than a nightmare that we're now waking up into? It's absolutely atrocious. And when you combine this with the additional demonstrations of complete contempt for law and for legitimacy and transparency of government from the Oregon standoff and the murder of Lavoie Finicum, as well as some of the atrocious things they're doing in the Middle East, This really does take the cake, though, to have done this to a Supreme Court judge and to have the audacity to say there's no need for a major investigation. They lose all legitimacy as representative government.
And Scott, the disrespect shown by Obama for Scalia is becoming scandalous. He came out to announce it without wearing a tie. And today he's observed that he's not going to attend the funeral service, but send the vice president instead. I mean, this is a justice of the Supreme Court. I'll bet there isn't a precedent for a president not attending in the past. Starman even suspects the reports of Scalia having a pillow over his head could represent a message being sent in the style of The Godfather. Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes. The pillow over Scalia's head wasn't put there by an Hispanic maid. The pillow over the head is a warning. Jack Graham, you must share with us your thoughts, too. I mean, isn't this a disturbing case?
Well, it's a disturbing case, whether or not the report about the pillow is accurate. it is clear that the news media were telling us that he died of natural causes before a physician had examined the body and before the case had been taken before a justice of the peace. It is also undisputed that this is a case where normally, under normal practice, under this Texas statute, there would have been a formal hearing to determine the cause of death. Even if they were clearly of the opinion that he died of natural causes, they would have, in this case, had a hearing. And there would have been a formal inquest in that sense. They would have taken evidence. There would have been an autopsy, but there was no autopsy. The idea that they would embalm the body very quickly before any toxicological tests could be taken to determine whether the judge may have had something put in his drink or something like that or in his food that would have induced a heart attack, that's just scandalous, and it is so obviously wrong.
And here's a report from another former head of criminal investigations for the District of Columbia, William O. Ritchie. As a former homicide commander, I am stunned that no autopsy was ordered for Justice Scalia. You have a Supreme Court justice who died, not in attendance of a physician. You have a non-homicide-trained U.S. Marshal tell the justice of the peace that no foul play was observed. You have a justice of the peace pronouncing death while not being on the scene, without any medical training, opining that the justice died of a heart attack. What medical proof exists of a myocardial infraction? Why not a cerebral hemorrhage? How can the marshal say, without a thorough postmortem, that he was not injected with an illegal substance that would simulate a heart attack? Scott, I mean, this is getting beyond suspicious.
Well, I'll read you, Jim, what I quickly wrote about this, which summed it up pretty well. And that is, on an action level, charges should be filed against all parties involved for depraved indifference, dereliction of duty, misprision of felony, conspiracy to commit murder, first degree murder, conspiracy to assassinate a public official, interference and obstruction of a public official in performing his duties, and civil rights violations. Those are the charges that should be levied against all people involved in this conspiracy to cover it up. By registering these charges in a court of law, the discovery will come to light, subpoenas issued, and all kinds of documents, admissions, affirmations, and witness lists will appear. The facts are that all parties involved in the timeline of this event are suspect simply because the regular protocols and minimum standards of investigation and medical analysis were not performed. The reason for not performing these absolutely necessary actions are either one, depraved indifference, two, conspiracy to commit a crime, or three, inexcusable ignorance. Judging by the professional histories of all people involved and their documented actions and standards and practices of processing similar crime scenes and similar events in the past, similar to any death of an American citizen, it's clear that the established procedures were not followed, and most likely out of some conspiracy to commit political corruption, undermine the Constitution of the United States, and commit other unlawful acts. Congress must be held to account for not holding an immediate investigation and exposure on the House and Senate floor. Now, anyone who claims this is a personal family matter, bull. It's not a personal matter. It's not a family matter. This was my Supreme Court justice, and I have a right to know exactly what's happened to him, because they, in the suspect of a commission of a crime and murdering him, they've done it because of his political affiliation. They've done it because of his judicial philosophy. So he's, by affecting him, by doing this to him, they've done this to all Americans. So we should reject wholeheartedly this defense of, well, it's a family issue and we decided we'd get him embalmed, or, you know, we wouldn't launch an investigation. Sorry, that doesn't cut it. He's not your family member. He's my Supreme Court justice. He is public property. In a sense, anytime a person becomes a public official, they become public property.
There's, I think, no, those are very well thought sentiments. Don't you, Jack, agree with everything that Scott just said?
Well, so basically, yes, because there is no right of the family to prevent necessary precautions under the Texas statute that applies here. There is no, I'm talking about Texas Criminal Code, Title I's, Articles 49.04 of 49.14. The family has nothing to say about this. And it's like saying that, Kennedy was shot, that Jackie could prevent necessary medical procedures to determine the cause of death and the circumstances of death. Jackie wouldn't have anything to say about it.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You could also say, just for the sake of argument, it's not beyond the pale to say, well, what if the family participated in this murder? What if they planned to do it? What better excuse than, all right, we'll bump him off, we'll get rid of my old uncle Scalia, and I'll get paid $100 million from Israel or some other country that's got an interest. And then we're his family, so we're not going to do an autopsy. Yeah. Now, I'm being facetious, of course, but that's what the law is all about. You do not allow this sort of conspiratorial action to be, like you said, Jim, a justice of the peace, a sheriff without any medical, and now the family saying, well, it's a personal matter. It's just too convenient and too fast-tracked.
We'll get further into it. This is from the anti-New York Times, which observes that there isn't a trace in featured story editorial pages of any sympathetic coverage that the Times typically affords to recently deceased prominent liberals and whatever. I mean, the entire tone of these stories has been, hey, he died, who's going to replace him? They say not even a few moderately respectful words about Scalia, the man, the father of 9 and grandfather of 28. Plus, there doesn't appear to be a single sentence in the Times about the strange circumstances and inconsistencies or the explosive comments made by William O. Ritchie, the former head of criminal investigation in Washington, who wrote on his Facebook page, my gut tells me there's something fishy going on in Texas. As a former homicide commander, I am stunned that there has been no autopsy ordered. I mean, those points I made before, how can a marshal say without a thorough postmortem he was not injected with an illegal substance? Did the marshal check for petechial hemorrhage under his eyes that would have suggested suffocation? Did he smell his breath for any unusual odor that might have suggested poisoning? I mean, all these seem to me to be highly appropriate issues to raise about what's going on here.
I think the New York Times did have, you know, a story about Scalia's career, but they didn't say anything about the gross lack of ordinary precautions that would be followed in a case of this kind in investigating a death of this kind. All I hear is that they're telling me, I read their story very early in the morning on Sunday, and I couldn't believe it. They were saying he died of natural causes. I'd say, how would they know that at this point?
Yes.
How could they possibly know that? How could they know that without an autopsy?
That's right. I mean, an autopsy has determined whether or not it was natural causes, and if not, what were the causes, and if it was, what were they specifically? I mean, well, this is outrageous.
If it was believed in good faith that it was natural causes, they would still have an autopsy.
That's right. I mean, this is an associate justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And look at this. This resort was way out in an isolated area of 30,000 acres. He was alone. His Secret Service protection had been withdrawn. He was in the El Presidente suite. I mean, that's very, very troubling. If, in fact, Obama had anything to do with this, you know, having him bumped off in the El Presidente suite is a bit of an outrage.
Yeah.
And here it turns out this huge thing, this Cibolo Creek Ranch, is owned by a Texas millionaire, John Poindexter, who is a longtime personal friend of Obama, who in one of his first duties upon being elected to bestow a war medal on Poindexter for his service during the Vietnam War some 40 years ago. I mean, isn't that bizarre, Scott? What do you make of that?
well, that's it. I mean, the ranch, the ownership of that. I mean, there's funniness, but you know, the simplest thing we come back to is the irregular, unorthodox treatment of this crime scene. And that's what it is until it's determined by a coroner and a medical professional who examines the body to determine that the guy wasn't injected with heroin. He had a prostitute perhaps with him. Who knows what was going on? I mean, it's not beyond the pale to say he had a group of little boys in the bedroom with him and somebody jagged him with a heroin needle and suddenly, you know, he died. Well, I'm not saying that was the case, but how do we know until all of these things are determined? And they're running away from it is very suspicious.
Scott, believe it or not, that was my wife's reaction. She's very much into mystery books. She's constantly reading all the time. She loves shows like Law and Order. She said, because of the delay from the presumptive time of death and the announcement that they were cleaning things up, tidying things up. And it may have been some very fetching young women, or it may have been a bevy of little boys, as you're suggesting.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Now, look at this. The key players here are extremely suspicious. John Poindexter, the multimillionaire I mentioned already, he has high-level Wall Street ties, owns the secluded resort. He received the Vietnam War Medal 40 years after the fact. It was Poindexter who invited Scalia to his ranch for a private party and who later discovered the body. Then we have Cinderella Guevara, get that name, who's a justice of peace who refused to order an autopsy and pronounced Scalia's cause of death as a heart attack, since changed to natural causes, over the phone. She's a liberal Mexican-American Democrat with a chip on her shoulders against those she refers to as Anglos. Her campaign slogan in 2014 was, "Yes, we can." She's also an Army veteran. Then we have Danny Dominguez, the sheriff of Presidio County, who along with Obama's U.S. Marshals initiated the official inquest by calling Judge Guevara and telling her there were no signs of foul play. He's also a liberal Mexican-American Democrat who's virtually crime-free county, has been receiving big bucks from Obama in recent years. Jack, how does all that strike you?
I'm just saying there's a remarkable parallels with the death of Abraham Lincoln. If you have studied this, the behavior of the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who made sure that Lincoln would not have proper protection, who never punished the guard who wasn't present in the hallway, enabled Booth to come in and enter the presidential booth and shoot the president. It's like Stanton refusing to close the only bridge over the Potomac that over which Booth escaped. It's like he never punished the guard. It's the fact that Stanton convinced General Grant not to attend the theater with him. Grant's presence would have assured ample guard and so on. All of these things tell us that Stanton is an obvious suspect, and yet he's passed over. And we hang Mrs. Surratt to get rid of, you know, to give the people a pound of flesh.
Well, I mean, here's just one illustration of what could have happened. This is when Frank Church was conducting his hearings and discovered the CIA had all these exotic weapons, for example. I mean, he's found with a pillow over his head, and then he's pronounced dead over the phone without even investigation. Whether the CIA has what's known as a heart attack gun that can commit murders without leaving a trace, it fires a heart attack-inducing dart into the victim, leaving a tiny needle-sized hole that might not be discovered even by a keen-eyed professional medical examiner during an autopsy. As a projectile dart from the gun enters the body, it melts, leaving no trace of the deadly chemical used to induce heart failure. Now, I mean, this isn't a fringe conspiracy theory. We have all this evidence before us right now involving this most controversial, outspoken, and principled. This is the most influential member of this Supreme Court. And I'm very, very troubled by this. Scott, isn't this just simply getting overwhelming?
Well, you've got the evidence and the material that you can lump into a complaint, a criminal complaint and a charge. I mean, they sued O.J. Simpson in a civil trial after the criminal thing fell apart. Well, you can do the same thing in this event, but you've got, as you said, the criminal dart gun, the assassination gun that you could say this man was killed using this technology and the cover up. Indicates it, and we've got other material, other witnesses, and other testimony that will be brought into a jury that will determine that he was murdered and that other parties knew about it and they purposely covered it up. Once you start throwing stuff in the mix into a court environment, then the cat's out of the bag, Pandora's box is opened, and all sorts of things that they thought they were going to be able to control, suddenly they're chasing balls in every direction. Watch this Poindexter guy, this woman, and the other sheriff. Watch them very closely, because watch their fortunes change, or perhaps they'll die off too. But they could get very rich very quickly or retire and disappear to an island somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it turns out now there have been arguments about what Obama's going to do in replacing him. But that's like a changing the subject, you know. No one's paying attention to the circumstances of his sudden death, which one would have thought would have been the obsession of the news media for at least a week. I would say at least a week under these circumstances. Well, and yet, as though it even happened, John.
One thing that could happen is that they could conduct a grand jury to determine whether there is probable cause for misprision of felony. That means cover up for a felony. And just a misprision of felony would be enough to justify a grand jury investigation. You could ask, why was there no autopsy in a case of this kind? Why was there no regular hearing by way of inquest? Why was there not an inquest jury? Why was death determined to be of natural causes by in the major news media before even a physician examined the body and so on? And then who you would eventually find out who was responsible for all of this. And I think that there would be probable cause. Just a moment.
Yeah, Scott, go ahead and fill in. Jack's distracted. Yeah.
One thing that he raised, which is very good, the misprision of felony, but you can add more lumps of clay on that. Depraved indifference. The reason that you did not give Mr. Scalia the rights that all Americans are afforded when, if they go through a similar circumstance and they're killed, it's expected as a right of an American citizen to have this investigated so that if you are murdered, your blood will cry out from the ground and the perpetrator will be punished. Mr. Scalia was denied those rights because you didn't like him because he's a gringo. He's a white man. He's a conservative judge. You didn't like him because you're a Mexican, Cinderella Guevara and you hate everything that he represented. And the same with you, Poindexter, and the same with you. Yeah, you lured him, but then you deceived him and then you killed him, or you didn't know what happened to him, but you didn't care. You were depraved, indifferent. Oh, he's dead. Someone may have killed him, but you know what? We're not going to ask questions. We're going to try and cover this up. So Scott,
the circumstances are just so damn suspicious. You would think in a case like this, the government would do everything it could to alleviate those concerns, to make sure everything above board and in accordance with SOP, and none of it is in accordance with standard operating procedure.
Every American should call their member of Congress and say, what are you doing? What haven't you done? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? Because this man this could represent a major terrorist assassination. My God, he could have been killed by the Russians. If you want to throw out all sorts of possibilities, anybody, the Iranians, everybody that we're picking fights with, could have done something, but we don't know because we haven't done the requisite investigation. Senator, Congressman, you represent me for a purpose. What are you doing about this? And
I think, I think that you just to comment about this, about writing your congressman, I can guarantee you that if you write your congressman and lay down the primary forensic evidence that there was a collapse of the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center on account of controlled demolition. I guarantee you can be a friend from childhood, and you can write and ask for some attention. I guarantee you will not get a return phone call. You will not get a return email. You will not get a return letter. You will be thereafter regarded as a kook in your office, and the staff will be told, if that man ever contacts me again, don't answer. That's what will happen. You can break a friendship by simply asking a member of Congress to look into something like the collapse of the Twin Towers, or why there was no video or physical evidence of a plane hitting the Pentagon.
You're right. And let me just ante up and add a little more money to the pot. I've done it for something that I was directly hands-on experienced in, discovering terrorist financing coming from Swiss banks. I was the man who found it. For God's sake, I found the little leprechaun's pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and I carried the damn pot over to the congressmen and senators and said, here it is. And I know what I'm talking about because I did it for a living in the Army. So nobody's more qualified, senator or congressman, to lay this at your feet and say, here's the proof that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are being financed through Swiss banks, and there's major cover-up, and Americans are dying because of it. And they did exactly what you said. They refused to debrief me. They refused to respond. And they kept me in prison to fight my way out until now. So you're exactly right. But it's even more damning because they did it to me when I had the goods on them. I had the blood on my hands coming from Brad Birkenfeld himself.
And if anyone wants to know why Trump and Sanders are so popular, they're authentic. They're not corrupt. They're not like the establishment politicians who won't take responsibility for anything and just live on lies that they feed to the public. It's such a disgrace. And here I'm troubled by this article talking about important cases because it leaves out some of the most important. Scalia was a bastion of support for the Second Amendment. Obama has been doing everything he can to undermine the Second Amendment. In addition, Obama has a very big climate control agenda. Scalia had issued an opinion that was blocking the implementation of Obama's climate control agenda that represents billions and billions, hundreds of billions in the future with new programs and progress. And the fact that he won't even go to the funeral, that he doesn't even put on a tie to address the man's death, that is very, very disturbing to me.
Well, that's right. This kind of thing. There are many, many telltale signs about this. They constitute probable cause to justify an inquiry. I believe that there is it could be very easily, I'm a former prosecutor. I did a lot of grand jury work in Minnesota during my term as a county attorney. And there is certainly enough evidence to constitute probable cause for misprision of felony under Texas law.
Yes.
And I think that you would have to do it under Texas law. But the fact of the matter is that this Cinderella, whatever her name was obviously either acting out of extreme bias, or she had been threatened or told
Look how Poindexter sets him up, lures him up to this obscured location. He doesn't have his Secret Service protection. He's found dead with a pillow over his head. Nothing is done to conduct a proper examination of the body to determine the cause of death. I don't know how the circumstance could be more blatant that this appears on its face to have been an assassination.
Yeah, well, and I can tell you, though, that nobody in Congress is going to mention a thing about this. If you bring it to the attention of your congressman, you're going to be blocked. You'll be blocked. You will be put on a blacklist and treated like a fringe kook.
Well, you know, the advantage of every time we put truth to these members that are supposed to be vanguards, that are supposed to be the representatives of our government, when we put these blatant, as Jim says, demonstrations of evidence of assassination and at the very least misprision of felony, when we make a stand for truth and righteousness and law And these men and women in Congress that are supposed to be the perfect tuxedo-wearing, beautiful expressions of sophisticated statesmen do nothing. And as you said, blacken us and cover us up and reject us and do all sorts of things to stop us from calling again. Then they are the picture of Dorian Gray. They are not the beautiful people. They are the monstrous scum. And that emboldens us to conquer them and remove them from office and run for office ourselves or get people that are manly and willing to stand up. And we can't surrender our country to a generation or a paranoia state of mind. You know, the mental state of America is a paranoid state. We just can't surrender that. There's something in us. I know Jim has it because he's a former Marine. I'm Army. And I know there are men and women in America that will not tolerate that. And these are the triggers that separate the men from the boys, the sheep and the goats, the leaders and the cowards. So we have to stand.
I think we're all in agreement here on multiple reasons that something very, very disturbing has happened here. And it appears to be of a criminal character and to have political motivation. And I was stunned when Obama comes out and it seems to me to divert attention, makes an attack on Donald Trump, to shift the public's consideration from the death of a Supreme Court justice who served longer than any other justice on the Supreme Court. Mark those words. This man served longer on the court than any other justice, and Obama is treating him like it was yesterday's news, like it was tossing a newspaper, or worse.
Well, Obama is a very cheap character. I mean, you know, it was very clear that he is a second rate character. The business about his birth certificate, I'm sure you're familiar with Sheriff Opio's five forensic videos that show clearly that the image of the certificate as posted on the White House website was a computer generated forgery.
Yes, the Hawaiian birth certificate is a fraud, and there are two from Kenya, one of which is fraudulent, the other of which has a footprint, appears to me to be authentic.
Well, that might be, and I do know for sure that on the day that Obama was supposedly elected in November 2008, there were speeches in the Parliament of Kenya in which Obama was proclaimed to be a natural-born son of Kenya.
Of Kenya.
Yeah, well, not only has he not produced a certified copy of his long-form birth record under seal for manual inspection, which would settle the question, because that is enough under the federal rules of evidence to prove his natural-born citizen. He hasn't produced that. All he has to do is file it with the Secretary of State and invite any member of Congress to subpoena it before a committee in which he sits for manual inspection. That's all he has to do. But he hasn't done that. He's tried to laugh it off. Now, if this kind of stuff, and then the news media immediately covers it up. The same news media who are obviously covering up the fact that there was not, the normal processes for determining the cause of death were bypassed here. Misprision of felony is a crime that existed at common law, and it was designed to deal with exactly this type of situation. Okay, the evidence has been destroyed. There's nothing we can do about this, but you can get the people who helped do the cover up. And that would include Justice Cinderella, whoever she was.
Yeah, I agree completely, Scott. I think we're on the same page here.
Yeah,
now, there's
absolutely
another related interesting development, which is Trump has resurrected issues about 9/11 and whether George W. Bush kept us safe, as his brother Jeb has asserted. And while he was booed when he said that Bush was wrong to claim he kept us safe, that was because the audience was loaded with lobbyists and representatives of the establishment by the Republican National Committee. Scott, did you check all that out when it was taking place?
Yeah, I did. And it was sad and sickening that you've got the place peppered and sprinkled with so many cowards and simpletons. But of course, it's an indication of the corruption. The hope is that Trump is strong enough and will carry 50% plus one of the smart people in this country. And you got to hope and trust that there are 50% plus one of smart people in this country. They're not all a bunch of rabid lunatic environmental communists. But
by the way, let me say that because South Carolina is going to be on Saturday, they ran a national poll that is obviously a fraud, suggesting Trump was losing ground. Trump supporters are never going to abandon Trump. That was such an obvious effort to affect the vote in South Carolina for people who feel they want to vote for the winner. And if they think Cruz is ahead, might be disposed to vote for him.
Now, I think you're right. I think Trump's going to carry it. And he's got the ability to win the majority of independents. And that's who will decide the election. Are the last 2 weeks before they pull the trigger, the last 2 weeks are when people who make the difference will choose their candidate. And if it comes to Trump and Bernie Sanders, they're going to go with Trump because he's a younger guy. He's a little more handsome. He's more successful. And he's got kids. He's got grandkids.
He's dynamic. He's a successful businessman. He understands what goes on in the world. He's a natural born leader.
And Putin likes him. The Russian like, and everybody wants to be friends with Russia again. They're really upset that we've started this fight with Russia over nothing, over silly stuff. And the silliness is this whole fiasco in the Middle East that everybody is dying to get out of. And they just keep feeling themselves sink deeper and deeper into the tar pit. And now they're looking at their relatives in Europe. And make no mistake, the majority of this country have relatives, blood ties to the European generations, whether it's Britain or Germany or Scandinavia, that's where Americans have their blood ties. They don't have it to Africa. They don't have it to the Middle East. They don't have it to China. The majority of Americans have blood ties to Europe, and they see Europe being destroyed by Obama and these Middle Eastern wars. And I think the more that comes into focus, the more Americans are just going to be outraged, and that outrage will vote for Trump.
And who wants to support a candidate who has to campaign with his mother? I mean, that's about as absurd a proposition as I've ever encountered. And then he campaigns with the most unsuccessful, the worst president in the history of the United States. That's going to earn him a lot of votes.
Yeah, not to mention all the CIA money that came out of Panama and all the various banks and the CIA drug operations, a lot of which I saw in the training that I went through in Deep Black. I mean, this guy Bush is as dirty and stupid as incompetent as anybody could be.
Let me
give you a little point here. Once you understand the forensic evidence about the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7 at the World Trade Center on 9/11, once you understand that forensic evidence, you say, well, then who did it? Who planted the explosives? The best suspect is the Project for a New American Century and their connections. Guess who signed the charter principles, the charter for the Project for a New American Century? Guess who signed it? It was Jeb Bush. They were the ones that said, in order to incite the American people to support an invasion of Iraq, we have to have a new Pearl Harbor. That was their report in September 2000.
Well, my boss was Dove Zackheim. I don't know if Jim shared with you that, but Dove Zackheim was my boss. I was sent down on special secret orders to see all these buggers. I mean, we won't even get into that drama.
But Dove Zackheim was a controller of the Pentagon when it went missing, $2.3 trillion. By the way, Trump's observation that W didn't exert due diligence here is confirmed, for example, by Colleen Rowley, who was the FBI special agent involved in the terrorism investigation, saying on the specific issue of the Bush administration 9/11 and Iraq blunders, Donald Trump is absolutely telling the truth, even though he may not be politically correct. And that's all these Republicans care about, political correctness. And get this, there's a brilliant article in The Atlantic demonstrating he's right about 9/11 And it goes through all the dates, all the times, all the meetings where CIA Director George Tenet and where the anti-terrorism czar Richard Clark repeatedly tried to arrange meetings time and time and time again, time and time again. In fact, they made more than 36 efforts to bring the attention of the Bush administration to this issue, all of which were rebuffed. And it would finally happen that there was a proposal to pursue the project that Clark had recommended for anti-terrorist investigation on Bush's death on 9 September. When it, of course, was too little, too late, but we know the real truth is they were organizing it behind the scene, and therefore they didn't want to invite any attention to it. Jack?
Well, isn't it true that the point that was made a while back about how the press are doing everything that they can to discredit Trump as he starts resurrecting 9/11 and he talks about the error of going into Iraq and so forth? That's what has incited them to go into after Trump. But isn't it true that from the beginning, Trump was not considered by the major media as a serious candidate? And every time, the characteristic of Trump is that every time they go after him, his popularity has increased.
Yes, yes, yes. And I can't believe this phony poll. I mean, it's obvious to me this is a phony poll, and it's intended to try to suppress the Trump vote in South Carolina. I don't think it's going to happen any more than the endorsement by the young, charming governor of South Carolina, Marco Rubio, is going to give his candidacy a big boost. They're a cute couple together if you look at them photogenically, but, you know, really. Cruz, it turns out, had a youth where he was a gay hustler with rich men in parks down in Miami Beach. It's an absolutely awful story.
There's got to be a picture of him in the San Francisco gay parade somewhere, Jim. We'll find it.
I'm sure it's true, Scott. Now, here I put up Susan Lindauer's book because she was the liaison between the CIA and Saddam Hussein, who was so eager to avoid war with the United States that he offered to buy 1 million cars a year for the next 10 years. And when she was about to depart, he added, if that's not enough, make it 20. Jack, imagine where we would be if instead of going to war in Iraq, causing chaos in the Middle East, squandering $4 or $5 trillion, we'd allowed Saddam Hussein to buy 1 million cars a year for 20 years, where the auto industry has a tremendous multiplier effect with electronics, rubber, tires, stereo, leather, the like. I mean, it's really stunning the difference the world would be if we'd only done that instead.
Well, these people who were behind the project for a new American century are essentially people associated with the Bilderberg Group, which set up the North America, the European Union, and is trying to set up a North American Union of the same type upon the ruins of Mexico, the United States, and Canada, all based upon a single currency bank and government, which they will run from behind the scenes like Wall Street runs the United States behind the veneer of the Federal Reserve. So, I mean, the problem with what's going on in the United States is that we have been subverted from within.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely true, Jack. You're right on target. And by the way, let me just add this observation. Condoleezza Rice insisted that no one had ever contemplated the use of planes as weapons, but that's simply historically false. There was an Operation Bojanka that was going to use multiple aircraft as weapons. And in the months prior to 9/11, the Pentagon itself even conducted a simulation of the effects of a Boeing 757 hitting the building, which is represented here.
Never hear of the kamikazes during World War II? What are they talking?
Nice point, yeah. Jeff. Nice. Yeah. Scott, isn't it outrageous here? Fascinating.
Well, it's like you had said, when you look at the forensic analysis of the World Trade Center towers and the impossibility of them falling down as a result of a plane impact, and then the ludicrousness of Building 7 suddenly going down, and the recordings on the camera when it fell down after they said it was taken down or after, I can't remember. There are so many little things that we're now being able to splice together into a cohesive storyline that overwhelmingly, even the most retarded mongoloid American citizen would go, oh, wow, that's impossible for the government narrative to have occurred. It's physically, scientifically impossible. So what did happen? Something else.
That's right. No steel structure high rise has ever collapsed due to fire before 9/11, after 9/11, or on 9/11. It was actually physically and engineering, from an engineering point of view, impossible for those buildings to have collapsed. There's a whole lot about it, but let's turn to another story that isn't receiving any attention in the mainstream media in the United States, which is that there's a massive assemblage of 350,000 soldiers, 20,000 tanks, 2,450 warplanes, and 460 military choppers in Saudi Arabia involving contributions from the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, Sudan, Kuwait, Morocco, Pakistan, Tunisia, Oman, Qatar, Malaysia, and other nations. Scott, this is just stunning that this should be taking place, and it obviously augurs a massive invasion of Syria.
The only thing that upsets me is, and I've said this on Press TV in the interviews, is Russia's failure to learn how to wage a proper PSYOP war, how to wage a proper information operation war. Yes, they've got the kinetic strength to smash and destroy every one of these Saudi Arabian Wahhabis who comes in wearing a man dress. That's not difficult. These people couldn't fight their way out of a paper bag. We've said it before. But the fact is Russia shouldn't have to do that. They should be so much more aggressive on the psychological warfare level, the information operations, the strategic communication to say, you know what, we're about order and stability and peace in the Middle East. The United States is about chaos. And look at what they've done. They've destroyed Libya. Putin said, do you realize what you've done? I think you were the one who said it before, Jim. And they're not as aggressive as they should be. And if they were more aggressive, most of the Europeans would say, you know what, we're going to join his team because he's about stability, and stability will stop these guys from coming up into Europe. And the United States is not our best friends, at least it's not with Obama. But
it does look, Scott, as though Erdogan has overplayed his hand as a tail attempting to wag the NATO dog, and the NATO nations are now creating some distance so that if Turkey undertakes a rash and impulsive action, they won't be drawn into it.
That's the promise. That's the hope, is that they're not going to be drawn in, and they're going to say, you know what, Russia, it's been a while since we've seen you fight. Why don't you go in there and absolutely destroy this country, Turkey, like a pit bull does a poodle?
And during the 1st or the 4th of February, Russian jets hit 900 ISIS targets. I mean, it was absolutely devastating. Russia's wiping them out. The United States has hemmed and hawed and done nothing for the obvious reason that we created ISIS. I mean, it's embarrassing.
Isn't our attempt to fight Assad, isn't that what created ISIS?
The idea was that we would create a force that would serve as a buffer to bring more pressure on Syria after the failure of the chemical attack, which actually came from the rebels, to allow Obama to start lobbing cruise missiles into Syria, where the American people stood up virtually as one and opposed
it. With the support of Mr. Putin.
They had to create a new method, a new approach, Jack, which was to create ISIS, where Judicial Watch, a conservative organization under Freedom of Information Act request, was able to pry out of the Pentagon the Defense Intelligence Agency's documents creating ISIS, where we even have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos, as I'll demonstrate. But in the meanwhile, propaganda. Scott, you talk about propaganda. They're claiming that Russia attacked these hospitals, but the United States did it to blame it on Russia, just as we attacked one of the Doctors Without Borders hospitals in Iraq. I mean, it's embarrassing.
And they steal the Russian footage of the Russian successful bombing runs. You see the French TV and NATO and the United States stealing that footage, pretending that those are U.S. planes doing bombing runs. They're not. They're Russian planes bombing the ISIS convoys of trucks. And let me just say this too, Jim. Brad Birkenfeld brought 24,000 Swiss bank accounts that were, a lot of them, run by Saudi Arabians like Prince Abdullah Aziz. and he showed them to Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer and Obama and Hillary Clinton. They threw him in prison. Why? Because all of that money they were tracking and moving up into their various operations. And they also, of course, Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer were working for Covington & Burling, the law firm that represents Union Bank of Switzerland. So all of that corruption's not come out yet. But this whole ISIS money tracking thing, we've known about since 2007, 2008.
And Trump's the one who's talking about going after their money, cutting off their oil. He's the one who's pointed out attacking Iraq was a complete mistake based on lies. There were no weapons of mass destruction. The people were deceived. They lied. We died. I mean, he's making devastating points, Scott, and the American people are responding.
Well, we sent Trump shell game and all the evidence and all the documents, and we sent it to Cohen, and we said, here it is. Do what you will. We're not trying to try and show you how to run the game, but he better be aware and he better do something about this or else he's going to be as bad as everybody else. So our suspicion is he's taking out and milking a lot of the intelligence, and he's comparing it to other intel guys. He's taking it saying, hey, what do you think about this? What do you see? Is this, what's going on here? And everybody who's military or special operations is going, yep, that's exactly right. That's right. That's that. Here's the whole thing. And suddenly Trump's going, aha, it's being verified from various sources.
Trump's a very smart guy. He has a lot of synthetic intelligence of putting data points together to figure out the big picture. Here is my latest article in Iran Review, How We Know ISIS Was Made in the USA, featuring Wesley Clark, who gave us the big picture himself at the Commonwealth Club of California on the 3rd of October 2007, explaining when he had returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, meaning Commanding General of NATO, he encountered a general in the Pentagon, and during a series of encounters learned that we had a plan to destabilize the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. Fortunately, because of the intervention of Vladimir Putin and Russia, it hasn't played out that way. But that was the agenda.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Tell me this, gentlemen, what do you think that, I've noticed that Marco Rubio and Barack Obama have both smugly stated that Trump isn't going to make it and so forth. It's interesting that that combination would say the same thing, because obviously they're getting their information from the same source, which is from the Council on Foreign Relations or some
other. I think this new national poll that's obviously fraudulent is one indication. Remember, in Iowa, the state-level GOP officials changed the numbers to make sure that Cruz prevailed over Trump, and where Cruz had played dirty tricks by announcing that Ben Carson was leaving the race and his vote should go to Cruz, and sending out a phony official-looking document that said, if you don't vote, you may be prosecuted. I mean, this Cruz is totally unscrupulous. His wife works for Goldman Sachs. I mean, he's absolutely in the pocket of the establishment in Wall Street.
What do you think, objectively speaking, Trump's chances are of getting the Republican nomination and then being elected?
Oh, virtually all the commentators agree, Jack, that if he wins in South Carolina, it looks as though there's no way to stop him. There are many of these states in which even if you win by a plurality, you take all of the delegates, okay? And I say, you know, we're going to see in the next couple of days, which is why South Carolina has been so hotly disputed. I believe Trump is going to win there and is going to earn the Republican nomination. Those are very thoughtful people who think it would be a great thing, but they're worried that he could be taken out. I mean, that he's such a threat to the establishment that they could actually pull a Scalia on Trump.
I think once Trump's kids start talking on his behalf, that will give him a lot of strength and cover fire. I think he's got a popular support, and when he becomes a populist president, then he will appeal as Ross Perot appealed to so many. The only thing Trump needs to do is soften a little bit and to low key himself and to go into a gentle mode now and then to balance his boisterousness and his bravado and his boldness. He needs to temper it at appropriate moments to show the soft side to the little old ladies in Peoria.
Well, Scott, I watched an interview with him and Charlie Rose just today, and it was precisely that. It was a very relaxed, very subdued, highly analytical, very articulate Donald Trump.
And he's brilliant. When he talks, it's like a Gatling gun, and that's why the press can't stand him, because they just can't. They can't follow him. He's
smarter than they are. They're used to very conventional politicians, and he's precisely the opposite.
Amen.
Here's one of the photographs of an ISIS member sporting a U.S. Army tattoo.
You think that if he gets the nomination, that he can beat Hillary Clinton and or
I do. I absolutely do. Yes, I do. Hillary's going down big time, Jack. Hillary has may even be indicted. You know, she's used this.
The only way she can avoid indictment is corruption in the DOJ or the FBI.
Well, Hillary's even more indictable because, I mean, I know firsthand and I have witness ability to testify, and I expect these cases to be coming up, that she participated in the terrorist financing cover-up. She participated in covering up Brad Brookenfeld's 24,000 bank accounts that showed that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all these Muslim mercenaries that DIA General Flynn reported after we reported this to General Mattis. And the whole thing that hasn't happened is to see how these dominoes have fallen. But I know that they fell because I was in prison with Brookenfeld, and him and I had a Jesus moment, and we started typing on a typewriter letters to General James Mattis and everybody else in the Congress, and that's when everything started to fall down and fall apart. They never reported it, but Hillary's directly indictable for that. On a political level, on a psychological level, she's too lesbian, she's too masculine, she wears pants, she's not a feminine woman, and the independents will vote for the person who's most like their traditional symbology of sex. Is she a feminine woman or is she a bull dyke? Is he a man or is he a feminine homosexual? And the average person will gravitate to the most normal gut feeling positive person. No one has a good positive feeling for Hillary except the rabid leftists and lesbians and angry people.
Scott, you and I agree that the moment that one of those Saudi Arabian tanks crosses into Syria, Russia is going to hammer and demolish, that this will be one of the most stunning disasters in the history of military affairs, and it may be happening in the next few days. I want to thank the both of you for coming on. We close with an image of videotaping the fake ISIS beheading videos on a soundstage in Tel Aviv or even Hollywood, gentlemen. In Washington, D.C., ISIS is known as John McCain's army. Thanks to Scott Bennett for being here, Jack Graham for being here. Stand by for the new JFK show with Gary King, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent O'Mara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
All right, welcome to the new JFK show number 92. So, been a more than unusual day. I'm not sure how much we're going to cover here today. However, we are going to ring the bell for round three as far as the Jim DiGenio response. Now, I'm not sure. I know there's a lot that went on at the OIC, and I'm not really sure how much we're going to go into that, but I'll let Jim Fetzer go ahead and take it away from here. Chance, we appreciate you being in the engineer's chair, buddy. So go ahead, Dr. Fetzer.
Well, thank you, Gary. This is like our third installment. If we catch the very first slide, Chance, this is like the third installment of our response to Jim DiEugenio, and there's some very important aspects of what we're discussing today, which because of which I'm going back to the beginning of our discussion of the man in the doorway, And I'm especially, that's slide number two, Chance. I think we're probably following as we go, since I'm controlling them here. It has astonished me. I mean, here's the objection. Alchin's photo, this is now Jim DiEugenio. I'm not going to detail here what Fetzer and Ralph Sinquet were propagating. It seems to me to be so wild, so far out, that was almost a caricature of those so-called tinfoiled hat JFK researchers were all about. So I refer the reader instead to the Oswald Innocence Campaign homepage, in which they spell out what they mean. For those who don't care to wade through all those pages in a nutshell, what they were saying was that in the famous Alchin's photo, the facial features of the figure of the Texas school depository doorway were done over in an attempt to hide its, that is Oswald's, identity. The object was to make it appear that it was Billy Lovelady. In other words, the photo was altered. Let me just respond immediately to that first paragraph. That the photo was altered is not in doubt. And Ralph Sinquet's contribution was to point out to me from the beginning that it wasn't the face that was key. It was the height, the weight, the build, the clothing, the shirt, the T-shirt that mattered. Because as I shall explain, when you compare those features, it's already obvious that this has to be Lee Oswald. After all, there are only two alternatives. No one other than Billy Lovelady has ever been proposed as the alternative to Lee. Although there is a third party who has been claimed to have been Billy Lovelady, who, as we shall see, obviously was not. So DiEugenio is just giving a straw man argument here, exaggerating the position. And notice he's not refuting anything about it. Here he says, continue. As others pointed out, there were films from that day which showed Lovelady outside the book depository with a plaid shirt on, and another film from inside the Dallas Police Department. The latter film showed both Lovelady and Oswald in the same room at the same time. One could see that Lovelady had a shirt on that was similar to the figure in the doorway. Further, a central tenet of Fetzer and Sinquet was that the doorway man figure was wearing a V-neck undershirt. Yet, when one looks at Robin Unger's finer resolution of the photo, to put it kindly, this is not readily evident. Well, this is just a crock. I mean, look, there was a guy in a plaid shirt both outside the building and inside, but he wasn't doorman. He had a red and black checkered shirt that was buttoned right up to the neck. The doorman was wearing a very richly textured shirt that was splayed open down to his navel. So DiEugenio is a non-starter here. I mean, his position is simply indefensible. He continues. And later turned out through better photo renditions and comparisons that the Fetzer Sinquet V-neck appeared to be an illusion from a chin shadow. This created a serious problem, since part of their argument was that Lovelady was wearing a round neck T-shirt and Oswald was not. Frankly, I've never heard the argument that Lovelady was wearing a round neck T-shirt and Oswald was not, but that the Oswald T-shirt does have poles in the center, and therefore the appearance of a V-neck is indisputable. For his version of Alchin's, Fetzer had used a scan from Life magazine, which of course did not make for a very good rendition of the photo. Finally, Pat Spear pointed out that Oswald had changed his shirt after he left the depository to go back to his rooming house. He did this since he did not think there was going to be any more work to do. Thus, a shirt that Fetzer claimed Oswald was wearing at the police station was not the same one he was wearing before the assassination. This, in turn, meant there was no control factor for the comparison, because we really do not know what shirt Oswald was wearing in the depository. In the Alchin's photo was a black and white, so it was not easy to be definite about its color and pattern. Well, I don't know where Pat Spear came up with this, but the shirt that Oswald was wearing when he was arrested, a very close proximity to the facsimile to the shirt on doorman. In fact, we have established that they are the same shirt for a series of arguments to be established. And the improbability that Oswald would have gone home and changed his shirt and come back with one that matched the shirt on doorman has got to be infinitesimal. This is just another ridiculous, exaggerated argument that bears no weight, carries no weight. It's an effort to clutch after straws. Larry, would you agree thus far?
Yeah, Jim, I wanted to mention, in fact, up the Fritz notes, because that's exactly where Pat Spear came up with the information about Lee Oswald changing his shirt. If you examine Fritz's notes, page one, which were done on the 22nd of November, they mentioned that he changed his breeches, his pants, but they don't mention anything about the shirt. And the same thing happens when they're talking about the cab and bus ride. They never talk about the cab ride until the next day, which on the second page of Fritz's notes, if you examine them very carefully the way that I have done, that's when the first mention of the shirt comes about as being on the 23rd, which was the Saturday. So on the very first day of Oswald's interrogations by Captain Fritz, this business about him changing his shirt never surfaced. So I just wanted to mention.
Yeah, it's a late add-on. They're grasping after straws.
Exactly.
I was dumbfounded in an exchange I had today and yesterday, including Chris Mulligan, who's the publisher of Trine Day Books, that he thought Oswald had said he was inside in the lunchroom, when in fact, as we know, the Fritz notes, he said he was out with Bill Shelley in front. So it's staggering to me that someone in a position such as that of Chris Mulligan would be so ignorant about the most basic facts about the issue of doorman. I must further say, by the way, that Ed Haslam has rather stunned me by seemingly being a critic of the case when I regard him as such a meticulous and objective student. So I'm dedicating our presentation this evening to Ed Haslam in the hope that he will reconsider by actually reviewing the evidence we present here, which will be very painstaking and thorough. So we know right off the bat that Lee told Fritz he was out with Bill Shelley in front when the motorcade passed by. And indeed, then in the Alchin's photograph, and this is a high-quality version, you can see the area that we are addressing where this individual appears to be extending out to see what's going on, that certainly bears a resemblance to Lee Oswald. Notice already you can tell his shirt is flayed open down to the navel. There are other properties here we'll consider as well. But this led me to begin looking around for Oswald in the doorway, and I came up with this. I found this on a John McAdams website, and I had a circle around a man whose face had been obfuscated, which I initially believed had to have been Lee Oswald. Otherwise, why would you alter an historic photograph to take out someone's face unless it was someone who should not have been there? Notice you have Billy Lovelady in the middle here, and to the right, the fellow I referred to as Gorilla Man, because as we'll see when we compare his profile and his build with that of Billy Lovelady, he's clearly not the same person. With Doorman, Billy himself observed he was 2 to 3 inches shorter than Lee and 50 to 20 pounds heavier and could not understand why they were ever confused. But Gorilla Man has got to be 30 or 40 pounds heavier than Doorman and bears no resemblance at all. But he was found in the some of this footage where he may even have been photoshopped into those frames. Larry, you're
definitely. And I definitely want to comment on this magnificent slide that you're presenting here, Jim, where you can clearly see the pocket flap, the breast pocket with the flap of Gorilla Man in the Martin film versus the Billy Lovelady standing in the doorway, which is a photograph taken by Bob Jackson from the Times Herald newspaper. Right there, I mean, you can tell, I mean, our audience can look at it. If you look at this slide, you can see right there that there is a breast pocket on the man, which we call Gorilla Man, clearly visible there. However, when you look at the Lovelady with this plaid shirt right there that you are indicating with the pointer, with the mouse pointer, there is no pocket flap there. So
there are also alterations to the sleeve in these photographs, which are in Robert Grodin's book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald. It's all terribly troubling because Grodin's history here is a very, very disturbing one, where he served as a special counsel, a special advisor to the HSCA to determine who was the man in the doorway. And he maintained that the shirt that Billy Lovelady had been wearing bore a closer resemblance to Doorman shirt than the one in which Lee Oswald was arrested, which we will discover is precisely the opposite of the facts.
That's right. And you don't see, I don't see any pocket flap on right now, right there on the isolation of doormat. I don't see any pocket flap there on the left breast pocket right there at his left breast. I don't see any. I don't know if you can tell, you know, from your angle there.
No. It's already clear that there's no pocket there, but we'll get back to it because we have another.
We'll get back to that. But
we have another slide, Larry, that shows it. Now, this is the frame that virtually every student of this question uses. It comes from Robert Groden, JFK Absolute Proof. And I just like to point out, you know, how anyone can claim it hasn't been altered when we have the man with the obfuscated face I'm circling here is beyond me. How anyone can fail to see that doorman is missing his left shoulder is beyond me. How anyone can fail to see that the black tie man is both in front of and behind doorman at the same time, which is a physiological impossibility, is beyond me. Anyone who cannot see that the man here wearing a short sleeve shirt with his hands raised to protect his eyes has had his face obfuscated is beyond me. All of these are very obvious indications of alteration in this particular area of the Alton's film. And this figure, Black Hole Man, is especially significant because that turns out to be Billy Lovelady.
Also, his chest is obfuscated. If you look at how his chest has been whited out.
Yes. No doubt to obfuscate that he's wearing a red and white vertically striped short sleeve shirt,
which
he showed to the FBI on the 29th of February, 1964.
That's right.
Now, here is Lee when he was arrested in comparison with Doorman. And it is a very richly textured shirt. It's worn. Look down at the bottom. It's splayed open. And if Di Eugenio has a problem with a V, look at this photograph. What could be more obvious than that there was a V there?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say that I have lost the sequence of the photographs. I think there's a way to get back.
Back up to
here
slides.
Here we go.
One more.
Yeah. One more.
There you go. Yeah.
No, I got to go here. I mean, look there. You can see the V-neck, and this not some feature of shadows or whatever. I mean, what does G. Eugenio think he's talking about? I believe he just took what anything anyone said that he thought could be used against us and used it regardless of the facts. He made no effort to verify whether that claim was or was not true. It's obviously false because there is a V-neck, and it's not to do with shadows. It's not an element of imagination. Very embarrassing that we have nothing better from Jim Di Eugenio than that. He's also made the claim, by the way, that Billy Lovelady was not asked to wear the shirt that he had been wearing on 22 November 63. That's precisely the opposite. Let me read a few sentences from the FBI report to J. Edgar Hoover. Billy Nolan Lovelady appeared at the Dallas FBI office at which time he consented to be photographed. Lovelady advised us that on the day of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, November 22nd, 1963, at the time of the assassination and shortly before, he was standing in the doorway of the front entrance to the Texas School Book Depository Building, 411 Elm Street, Dallas, Texas, where he is employed. He stated he was wearing a red and white, a vertically striped shirt and blue jeans, which they duly photographed, as the next photograph shows. I mean, what's ambiguous about that? It's described in the FBI report. It was the shirt he was wearing at the time by his own declaration. I mean, Di Eugenio is just committing the most shoddy kind of deception here, and it's clear that he has agenda and no interest in truth.
It's all just completely obvious.
And, is it not?
What's going across my mind more than anything, I guess I have to say I'm more heartbroken to where that we're actually explaining all this stuff to Ed Haslam. He's really a hometown boy, and I really hope that he does watch the show. And this is so obvious stuff. This is not...
I've told him it was dedicated to him tonight and invited him to show. Notice here, Billy is wearing a T-shirt that is a round neck, unlike Lee's a V-neck. But there's no question that Lee's shirt had a V-neck. My understanding is because he tugged at his shirt and created it that way. Here's the next. This is where you get the clear difference between Dr. Jekyll, Billy Lovelady, and Mr. Hyde, the imposter. This is why I referred to him as Gorilla Man. Look at the profile of this man. He looks like a gorilla. And while they've unbuttoned him here because they realize that's a problem, here he's buttoned right up to the neck. And notice, again, we have the pocket on the shirt, which turns out to be missing in the photograph to which Larry has made several references at this point in time. He does. This man does appear to have been in the doorway, but not up at the top where Lee and Billy were standing, but further down in the crowd. And I think they were desperate to find some alternative explanation and seized upon it. Would you agree, Larry?
Yeah, I wanted to also mention quickly here that we did craniometric comparisons, since you're able to see the profile of Gorilla Man, and we overlaid them with the Billy Lovelady's profile there, as seen in the FBI photograph. And they were like night and day, Jim. You know, the ears were positioned differently. The neck, the angle of the neck was completely different. The chin, I mean, it wasn't even close, you know. So.
The Eugenius argument is so slovenly that only someone who is utterly unfamiliar with the evidence in this case. Well, we probably published 30 articles about this, making one point after another in the most minute fashion, including into the Warren Commission hearings, the taking out of Buell Wesley Frazier and the like, Larry. To me, it's embarrassing that this man should be taken seriously as a student of JFK.
Yeah, he picked on the wrong people tonight. I mean, you two guys are the ones that you just can't mess with y'all about this.
Now, here you have a photograph for a comparison of the left sleeves that was done by Judith Mary Baker. And, in fact, she proved to be quite brilliant. Judith is a sensational student of science. It was because she was so successful, even already in high school, at developing a rapid-acting cancer in laboratory rats that she was invited by Alton Ochsner to come to New Orleans and participate in a project where he promised her admission to medical school without even having to complete an undergraduate education. But she compared the sleeves of them in the following study. Here you have the Alchins compared with Oswald at the top and the Alchins compared with Lovelady at the bottom. Now, mind you, this is precisely the opposite to the result claimed by Robert Groden, which means that he either did not know what he was doing or was deliberately obfuscating the evidence, because here it's very clear at the bottom, the Lovelady shirt bears no comparison to the shirt in the Alchin shirt at six, whereas Oswald is a very close comparison, and thereby has Judith eliminated that shirt from having been on the man in the doorway, Larry.
Yeah, and this was a study by Judith Berry Baker, and I just wanted to mention that when Ed Haslam did his presentation at her conference last November, he stressed the scientific background that Judith Berry Baker had, and exactly what you were mentioning, Jim, you know, and that she had been a prodigy, a teenage prodigy in her endeavors, you know, in her experiments, you know. As you mentioned, giving mice the cancer in such a fast time. And also another point that not many people know about, that she had been able to extract, I believe, magnesium out of the seawater, in a much more efficient manner than anybody at the time. And that was another thing that really attracted all of these universities and all these faculty and academics, you know, to Judith Berry Baker, and I thought that was very impressive.
I just want to reiterate that when Robert Groden served as a special advisor to the HSCA, he came back with the result that the Lovelady shirt was a closer match to the shirt on Doorman than was the Oswald shirt, as you can see here. That was a false report by Robert Groden on a crucial issue before the HSCA. And in my judgment, that is unforgivable.
And again, he also publishes in his book, Killing of a President, on page 187, where he has two images there of Gorilla Man, the Man in the Martin film, and the photograph that he took in 1976 of Love Lady in Denver. And again, I have to mention it again ad nauseum, you know, this thing about the pocket flap. You know, if they're not, if the one shirt does not have the pocket flap, then we're not talking about the same shirt, you know, and that's exactly what we're talking about. Thank you.
Here it is. Here it is. Here it is. No flap.
And wow. these images are taken from his, book, 1987. I mean, page 187, for the book, Killing of a President.
So is Robert Groden so incompetent he can't tell the difference between a shirt with a pocket and a shirt without a pocket? I mean, what are we talking about here? How profound is the depravity? How profound is the corruption involved here? When he can't even get a simple comparison like this accurate, something is terribly wrong.
Yeah, and all our readers have to do is look in his book, page 187 again. I have to mention it again and over and over and over again. You know, this is basic to the contention of, Billy Lovelady and his checkered colored shirt, the plaid shirt. You know, it just doesn't exist.
And I'm so impressed, Larry, with the work you've done in photogrammetry of applying, you know, a matrix, a mapping to the faces of these subjects to bring out their comparison. And while most of us believed in the beginning that Ralph had carried the case about as far as it could be carried in terms of the height, the weight, the clothing, the shirt, the build, and so forth, you have demonstrated that our prior belief that the face had been altered appears to be mistaken, with the possible exception of the hairline, about which I will invite you to comment further. And here, indeed, is one of your comparisons. Please talk about it.
Yeah, this is what in forensic science is called a photogrammetric comparison, where you lay both of the photographs of the individual side by side, and you can either use a grid with the ruler and or with the next slide, what you're going to present, you can draw lines across so you can extend and look at how the features line up side by side. This is complementary the overlay system that you saw in the previous slide, where we just overlay the features from the two individuals in question. That, like I said, is a complementary exercise to this photogrammetric system here, and both of them are completely valid, and they're used in forensic sciences all throughout the world. And once we line up with what is known as the interpupillary distance, then that is when we're able to determine. And we did a very lengthy show back in November about this, but I'm happy to repeat it again here. Once we establish the interpupillary distance of the individuals, then we can start to look at the differences in the other features, such as the nose, the mouth, the chin, the ear, and how everything falls into place. Okay, and then, thank you. And this is where we draw the line across, for example, at the top, you know, the eyebrows, and you can see the one on the right, the eyebrows extend higher from the red line. Then we go right under the nose, and you can see that the nose on the man on the right does not touch that line, and the chin as well. The chin on the man on the right extends further, a little further down from the red line. And like I said, the photogrammetrics are very important in identifying photographs of individuals like this.
Well, that's absolutely.
Are there people that are in prison or have gotten out of prison from this technique, Larry?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And this is also a field. There's a field that we mentioned before called biometrics, where even in airports and in security systems, where faces are scanned, in a way where they can be compared to databases, all right, of individuals in those databases to find out, you know, if we have criminals running around.
And here is a new photograph allegedly found by Robin Unger, as I understand it. And, you know, Larry, just as I look at this photograph of Lovelady, it looks to me the pixelization around the mouth is altered, that it's therefore almost certainly been touched up. But it gave you another basis for another comparison using another photograph.
Yeah, I was happy to see this one. I mean, because when we did our initial study in November, in October and November, we had to use flipped images, and we received a lot of criticism because of that. But when Unger, I had this article, but the photograph wasn't as clear as what Robin had supplied recently. And when I saw this, I said, well, wait a minute, this one isn't flipped the way we had to do the previous slide that you saw in the photogrammetric comparison. And what I did was I just used this one as a stock image of Lovelady, because, I mean, it's pretty obvious that they're trying to make him look as much as Doorman as possible, you know,
yes. Right?
Pursing the lips, you know, squinting the eyes, you know. But when they did that, right, when they did that, they sort of like threw all of the features out of alignment, actually. So if you look closely at the right, you know, when I set the interpupillary distance of that Lovelady, it shrank. It actually shrank his face, okay, in a horizontal plane, okay?
Yes.
And what it did, and you can see it, you can't tell very much, but what it did is it brought the ear in a way where the ear doesn't even match up
to it narrowed the face.
Exactly.
You're using Doorman's image as the background here for this photogrammetric comparison.
That's right. So, you know, for those who criticize us that we use the flipped image, you know, my answer to that is, well, hey, wait a minute. The flipped image looked better and align better than what this image does, because, you know, this is not a flipped image. And, you know, again, when I set the interpupillary distance and I put the grid and the ruler and everything, you know, it made me shrink that face even further to set that interpupillary distance, and it totally discombobulated the entire face in a way that it doesn't even look right. You know, it looks like looks like a cone head, you know, from
Live. and here you have a GIF attempting to show Lovelady as Doorman, and it's
right.
Rather obvious it doesn't work.
Right, and you can see that the ear doesn't even reach the ear. The ear is tucked in there in the dark area there on the left side of the image, and it doesn't even extend all the way to the ear of Doorman, because once I set the interpupillary distance, as you can see, the eyes are set exactly to the distance of Doorman. And I also wanted to mention something very important, Jim. Even if we did not use Lee Oswald as a subject in this study, okay, just by using this image alone, it excludes Billy Lovelady as Doorman, because as you can see, he obviously does not fit, you know, in the image of Doorman because of what I just mentioned.
I've argued from the beginning it was a simple argument by elimination. It's either Lovelady or it's Oswald, but it isn't Lovelady. And it, not only does that lead to the conclusion it's Oswald by this argument, but when you compare the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the T-shirt, it's obvious that it's Lee, because there's all that additional evidence. And your gift, Larry, which we aren't seeing yet, of Oswald's face filling out Doorman is just absolutely devastating. And I don't know if Chance had a problem with his computer, whether we're going to be able to see that now or not. Chance, are we able to see those GIFs?
MP4s. And those are, you know, those are that final nail in the coffin, Jim. But like I said, even if we did not use those images and those animations, you know, just by using this that you have here on the screen, I mean, it excludes completely.
No one has ever suggested any other candidate.
Yeah, I know, and they can't say that this is a flipped image. This is exactly the image that was provided, like I said, from this man, Robin Unger, you know, from that article when Billy Lovelady died. And again, they tried to make him look like Doorman, but they ended up making him look like a caricature.
And here's a wonderful comparison of their ears, Larry. Comment on this.
Yeah. I was researching that angle of the ears, and I discovered that both of them, when you look at the profiles, the position of the ears was completely different from one another, and that also is very important when you consider any comparison of Doorman, and that is the reason, the basic reason why Billy Lovelady's ear does not line up with Doorman, because he's not Doorman.
Because he isn't, yes, of course, needless to say.
Yeah.
I don't understand how anyone can continue to insist that it was Doorman when Billy was wearing a completely different shirt. I mean, already that was conclusive. Jones Harris, who was at the time dating Jackie Kennedy's social secretary, flew all the way from New York to interview Billy Lovelady, and Billy confirmed to Jones that he'd been wearing the short-sleeve red and white vertically striped shirt, which is already closing the case on this question. Billy's too short, too heavy, but was dressed the wrong way to even make it remotely case similar. And you have established that he's dissimilar with regard to the facial features as well, and the ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to also mention, Jim, since we published these findings back in October and November, nobody has come up with an alternate solution on this. Nobody has done the overlays following my methodology as spelled out in the paper. And I will debate anybody publicly or privately on this issue, Jim. And I will take this all the way, because this research is solid. Judy Baker was instrumental in moving this forward. And like I said, I will debate anybody.
Oh, I think your work's completely brilliant, Larry. It's objective, it's scientific. And anyone who would suggest there's any tinfoil aspect of this must be looking in a mirror. Because what D. Eugenio has said here reflects complete and utter ignorance, total incompetence. We have done our homework. He has not. And
let them bring their proof, and let's put all the cards on the table, and let the public decide. You know, once they see and they evaluate, the presentations, as it should be done.
Gary, did you want to get a word in edgewise?
I'm just sitting back here watching the champions just roll roughshod over the JFK community. Right.
Well, here's an early analysis of Richard Hook as to how it was done by moving certain parts, including of the features of the who may have been Jack Ruby to the left here with the black tie to create Black Tie Man. And I think they needed to move parts to get the right focal features and texture of the photograph. And that's why they moved internal features around. We have the face that's scratched out, obfuscated man. We have the face here. It's partially sketched in. Actually, Billy Lovelady there, Lee, all the features we've been talking about. And here, Ralph Sinkay. I mean, this single discovery by Ralph Sinkay transcends any contribution Jim DiEugenio has ever made in his entire career. Ralph Sinkay was so persevering, he discovered in response to the claims that the photograph, the Alton Sitch, had been published too early to have ever been altered, resonating with the claim of Tink Thompson that the film had been, had a chain of custody that didn't allow it to be edited, where he found that the News Palladium, for example, was one of a number of newspapers where the CIA went to the extent to create a whole separate phony issue. Larry, this is a staggering discovery. All by itself, it blows the whole lid off of the cover-up and the assassination of JFK.
Well, it also indicates, how many transformations the Alton Six photograph went through during the weekend, because these very first images of the Alton Six were extremely cropped. We did not get to see the entire photograph, and I'm just saying the entire in quotations, because if you study the type of photograph that Altus took, you'll see that the upper portion of the photograph has never been shown. I mean, beyond the trees and the upper parts of the Daltex building. But the first rendition of the Alton 6 photograph that showed the Daltex building and the fire escape there were not published until the Saturday Evening Posted on the 14th of
December. Of course, here you can still see the bullet hole in the windshield where JFK's left ear would be if his left ear were visible, which Robert Groden denies in the text of his book while showing a photograph where you can see the bullet hole. I mean, I'm telling you, that takes some nerve.
Which was discovered by Roy Schaefer, I might add.
Yeah, you got beating him over his head with his own book.
And DiEugenio goes after me and Ralph Sinquet as though we were unique here. There's a whole host. I mean, we must have 40 members of the Oswald Innocence Campaign already, including David Rohn, including Vince Salandri, including Abraham Bolden, including Jack White, Mark Lane, Gerald McKnight, and a host of others, and some of the most important figures historically.
Jim Garrison.
Oswald was in the doorway, included the Whitewash series author, Harold Weisberg, and no less than Jim Garrison himself, Larry.
That's right. And I wanted to mention that Jack White, if you examine the archives of the Deep Politics forum there, Jack White talked about and he wrote about that not only was the Alton 6 photograph altered, but he thought that all four of the Alton 6 photographs that showed events in Dealey Plaza had been altered, including 5, 4, and especially 7, where the famous photograph where you see Jackie pulling in Clint Hill into the limo. And in the background, you see Chief Curry has pulled the lead car to a complete stop, and you can see Sheriff Decker turned around, and the rear window has been completely obfuscated, and you have a little sliver emanating out of the flag, you know, covering up part of the rear window and stuff like that.
Let me just say that DiEugenio suggested people go to the pages of the Oswald Innocence Campaign. Well, this is their home page. And what do you discover? Photograph after photograph, the dozens and dozens of photographs of scholars, students of JFK, who confirm, agree to the proposition that Lee was in the doorway, which means this is a very peculiar case of special pleading, where he only cites me and Ralph Sinquet as though we were unique or idiosyncratic, when there's a very large number of very substantial students of JFK who agree with this proposition. And it's especially insulting when the man on whom he claims to be the world's greatest expert himself agreed that it was Oswald in the doorway, namely Jim Garrison.
Yeah, they have these people on their show sometimes. A lot of these people in the OIC go on Black Ops Radio often.
And first generation Vincent Salandri. I mean, how, you know, you can't get any more, direct than Vincent Salandri, you know, and he's a pillar among.
Vincent Salandri has the honor of having been the first to call out Josiah Thompson as a victim of disinformation, because at the conclusion of his book, which including the double hip theory, the Robert McClellan diagram and others offered ample proof of conspiracy, claims at the end of his book that none of this proves conspiracy, which led Vince to call him out. I was not the first. Vince has that honor, but I most certainly have offered substantiating evidence and pointed out that when he started to disavow his own double hip theory, which David Lifton had independently verified with Richard Feynman, who detected the motion from 312 to 313, completely independently, the world's most famous physicist confirms it. When he started to deny it, it was obvious to me that he was setting up to disavow conspiracy in the death of JFK for the 50th. And I published an article about it. Everyone should read the CIA, the New York Times, and Jake Thompson. You can find it online.
I have a very short anecdote that Vince Salandri told me about, because, you know, he's very active in the OIC, believe it or not, and he exchanges emails with all of the members that email him. But he told me about an incident where Josiah Thompson had been arrested over some protests, I believe in 1964. And Vince Salandri, as being a lawyer for the ACLU, went, you know, to defend these individuals. And to his amazement, Josiah Thompson was released, before anybody, without any reason that he thought that he could see, you know. And he immediately thought that perhaps this man was some kind of an agent provocateur or something of the sort, you know, where
he had to cover for the government.
That's right, where he was given special consideration and special treatment. And Vince, tells a story, you know, because he was there and he witnessed the entire incident. So
in in repudiating the man in the doorway is Jim DiEugenio, thereby repudiating Jim Garrison, whom he writes about so extensively? And why has he not shown the candor to acknowledge that Garrison's position was that Lee was in the doorway?
And we've shown Garrison in the videotape from his tape of the assassination tapes, which came out in 1992, okay, where he says, in fact, it was Lee in the doorway. We've played this on this program many times.
Let me ask if Chance can play those GIFs, because they're sensational. Chance, can you play the two GIFs that Gary prepared?
Oh, great.
Oh, you've been playing them. Oh, perfect, 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 perfect. Well, it seems to me we're in a position of demonstrating that, yes, somebody is incompetent. And if you put Jim DiEugenio and Robert Groden and Josiah Thompson on one side, and me and Ralph Sinclair, Larry Rivera, Don Fox, Gary King on the other, it's becoming increasingly obvious who is doing the job and who is not, who is exposing the truth and who is concealing it. Now, here's another complaint. Mary's mosaic. Fetzer now raises saintly, self-righteous manner to even higher amplitude. On Amazon.com, he called Janney's book a litmus test for the research community, one that would separate the competent from the frivolous, the courageous from the cowardly, and the honest from the dishonest. But, as with his commentary on Judith Baker, what became obvious in his review of Janney was that he knew little or nothing about the Mary Meyer case before he read the book. He simply accepted just about all that the author wrote as if it were fact, despite Janney actually using people like Gregory Douglas as a source. Janney also appeared on Fetzer's podcast more than once. Again, Fetzer did not challenge any of the tenets of the book. For instance, Janney had written that his suspected killer, William Mitchell, had disappeared off the face of the earth. And lo and behold, researcher Tom Scully, armed with only a computer, had found him living in Northern California, and it was a correct Mitchell. This is symptomatic of DiEugenio's methodology. He thinks if you ever held one position, that must be your position ever after. Peter Janney discovered information that showed that Mitchell was still alive, actually confronted Mitchell. So DiEugenio is simply distorting the history of the case. It's like the absurdity he claims about my work with regard to Gregory Douglas, which I'm going to address. Here he continues.
Yeah, he went and knocked on his door in California, Jim, and he filed a lawsuit.
I know, but you wouldn't hear that from Jim DiEugenio.
All of these people have already responded to this. See, what it appears to me, Jim, that and Larry, that this is the Santa Barbara conference. Every single person that's being criticized in this article was in Santa Barbara. And Judith Baker was supposed to be there as well. So I've actually had a radio show, excuse me, for 1 hour on each and every one of these people. You can see it online.
Well, I
asked them a brand. So what it looks like to me is that he took a lot of articles and he just put them into one and made it on the Sitka page and called it The Decline of Jim Fetzer.
Well, it's quite ridiculous. Let's read the further quote that Don extracted. If that were not embarrassing enough, Scully's information on Mitchell revealed that he was in his 70s at this time. Yet the late Leo DeMoor, Janney had adapted and used his work profusely in his book, said he'd met Mitchell in the early 90s and he was 74 at that time. How can a man not age in a generation? Further, Fetzer suggested that since Janney could not find any details of his academic career at Harvard, where he allegedly attended, that record must have been purged. But Scully found those records, once again armed only with a computer. This episode revealed in excelsis the severe shortcomings in Fetzer's critical apparatus. As this author has stated, criticism is nothing if not qualitative analysis. That is, one must examine the data the author adduces, where he got it, and how solidly backed it is. That rule is common one in historical analysis, but it is even more important for the JFK case for the simple reason that this field is littered with fraudsters, politically motivated spear jobs, and deliberate disinformation, which seems to me to be a perfect description of Jim DiEugenio's attack upon me here. I mean, this is bizarre. Mary's Mosaic is a completely brilliant book, and I believe why the CIA has been so upset is because Peter Janney delineates the methods they use in taking out Mary Meyer, which involved controlling everyone who was in the vicinity, faking, the person who would be proposed to be the suspect, luring an innocent bystander to view the event. These are kinds of methods of procedure that the CIA does not want revealed. They protect more than anything their own methodology. Now, I reiterate that this is a brilliant book and absolutely a litmus test, one which Jim DiEugenio has clearly failed.
Well, when you have to admit that your own father was involved in this type of operation, it takes a lot of guts, Jim, for somebody,
You're absolutely right. And as Gary was observing, Peter Janney spoke in Santa Barbara at the conference, JFK at 50, the assassination of America. Here was his abstract, tying up loose ends, the murder of Mary Meyer. Peter Janney grew up in Washington, D.C. during the Cold War era of the 1950s and the 1960s. His father, Wister, was a senior career CIA official. The Janney family was intimately involved with many of the Washington political elite that included the family of Mary and Cord Meyer, as well as other high-ranking CIA officials such as Richard Helms, James Jesus Angleton, Tracy Barnes, Desmond Fitzgerald, and William Colby. In his gripping book, Mary's Mosaic, 2012, Peter illuminates the magnitude of real-life evil perpetrated by the CIA far beyond that which most of us could ever imagine. A graduate of Princeton, Peter is a clinical psychologist who lives by the sea in Beverly, Massachusetts. And yeah. Peter, of course, gave a presentation. Everyone can find it online. Go to JFK, The Assassination of America, Part 3 of 6 by Peter Janney. And just to offer a couple of observations, this book on Amazon has had 299 Amazon reviews. The average of those reviews is 4.5 stars. This book was the winner of the 2012 Hollywood Book Festival for General Nonfiction. Honorable mention at the 2012 New England Book Festival for General Nonfiction. Honorable mention 2012 London Book Festival for General Nonfiction. It's been highly praised by a very large number of students. And here, let me offer a review, not by me. Magnificent and courageous too. 5 stars. David W. Manting. If Peter Janney's CIA father, Wister, were still alive, he would likely not be reading this book. After all, it provides convincing evidence that Wister knew that Mary had died even before the police had identified her body, which means that he, Wister, had foreknowledge of the murder plot. Peter also makes a strong case that Ben Bradley of the Washington Post likewise had advanced knowledge, perhaps also tipped off by Wister. When one's own father is so deeply committed to a cover-up, it requires enormous courage to disclose the family jewels. But courage is what Peter has, in spades. His relentless pursuit of long-hidden links and evasive witnesses leads to his final denouement, a truly remarkable Cold War murder mystery played out on the shores of the Potomac. If Peter is correct about Mary's execution and cover-up, then the CIA did not hesitate to throw away the life of an innocent black man, Ray Crump. That recklessness all by itself speaks volumes about the Cold War morals of the CIA. The two highly compartmentalized NPIC episodes with a Zapruder film on successive nights, November 23rd and 24th, 1963, are profoundly alarming. Short of some degree of film alteration between those two dates, why was this secret so tightly guarded? After all, Dino Bruglioni, who was on call that weekend for the NPIC, only learned of the second event after Peter told him about it. Furthermore, Bruglioni's recollections are at odds with the extant film, so at odds with the extant film that they raise overwhelming suspicion of film tampering that same weekend. With this book, Peter achieves a remarkable triumph, setting the historical stage with many quotations and facts for telling his personal story, which is so intertwined in this saga. Although it was a very different era, and that enemy spoke Russian, one can only wonder, with the current war on terror, how much of the stratagems and values change today. So is Jim DiEugenio also going to denounce David W. Manning, MD, PhD, the leading expert on the medical evidence in the world today?
Yeah, I was going to add to that, Jim. Let's not forget that it was also Peter Janney who brokered the interview, that magnificent interview that Douglas Warren did with Brugioni. Recently, it's on YouTube, and that was all done because of Peter Janney's intimate relationship with all these CIA people that he knew through his father.
Yeah, don't forget his father had a document saying if they don't do something soon, that Clay Shaw was going to be convicted, and they had to do something about Jim Garrison. So Jim DiEugenio is all about Jim Garrison, but he never really talks about that.
I think Jim DiEugenio is really all about Jim DiEugenio. And as we've been going through each of the complaints he's lodged against me, we find none of them have any substance. All of them are contrived. The evidence is overwhelmingly contrary to the position he adopts. He can find no fault in my research or the conclusions of those with whom I have been collaborating, as we have been demonstrating here again and again and again. So if Jim DiEugenio wants to propose that someone out here is a fraud and an agent of disinformation, I will agree to this extent. Either Jim DiEugenio or I is an agent of fraud and disinformation. The evidence is simply overwhelming, and I leave it to each of you to draw the appropriate conclusion. Mm-hmm. Mary, Gary, would you like to make any comments in conclusion?
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, well, you know, I communicate with Phil Nelson quite a bit, and because I also happen to believe that there was LBJ ducking, because even the cops, you know, including BJ Martin, the escort, had talked about that after the assassination. And I found actually yesterday and today I've been working on some collages which show this woman in the Alton 6 photograph who has been blocked out of the image, you know, with this ink blot, where she has her camera, apparently a Super 8, an 8mm camera trained, if you follow the line of sight, on LBJ. And so that is the reason that they erased her out of the Alton 6 photograph. She's right there to the left of the Alton 6 photograph, and there are two big ink blots covering those two women. There's two women there, and one ink blot is bigger than the other one, but the one on the right, you can clearly see the hand strap of the camera that she is recording the motorcade with. And she happens to be following the same line of sight that would have been, her camera would have been trained on LBJ. And had that film been, had it surfaced anywhere, it would have showed that LBJ was nowhere to be found in his limousine, you know, when the shots were ringing out in Dealey Plaza. And that supports, Phil Nelson.
Phil Nelson. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Let me just say, I think that one of the great advantages I have over someone like Jim DiEugenio is I know the limitations of my own knowledge, and therefore I bring in experts, as in the case of assassination science, David Manning, Bob Livingston, Chuck Crenshaw, and a host of others. Eventually, we'd be joined by John Costella. But in the meanwhile, also the work of Doug Horn and Vince Palomara and Doug Weldon.
Weldon.
You know, I mean, look at these books. I mean, and eventually David Lifton became a contributor as well. And my good friend out in Nevada about the techniques that were available for doing this kind of alteration of the film.
Gary Aguilar also.
And let us just say, yeah, which is a fascinating case because, need I remind us, that was the one article that Tink Thompson praised, a murder in Dealey Plaza, which by praising it meant that he was actually supporting evidence that contradicts his claims to the authenticity of the Zapruder film. So I think there's a lot of lack of rigorous critical methodology floating around here, but none of it is on my side, I dare say. This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guests this evening, Larry Rivera and Gary King. Gary, do you want to sign off?
Now, I just want to say it was truly fascinating watching the two top JFK researchers in the world hitting on all eight cylinders. We will be back for round four next week. This has been the JFK Show number 92. We thank you once again, Chance, George, and the engineer's chair. And just great job. Just totally fascinating watching you guys operate.
Thank you, Gary.
Next week.